Welcome to Real Flicks Reviews. We're like a book club for people who hate reading. This month we're doing movies you own, so James picked the movie Leon the Professional, made in 1994. We bring you movie news, and this week we have Judd the Attorney, James Stevens, and Ryan Preston. So here's the description for Leon the Professional, in the United States known as Leon-ish.
And in Europe it's pronounced Leon?
Close enough.
Just saying.
Matilda, a 12-year-old girl, is reluctantly taken in by Leon, a professional assassin. After her family is murdered, Leon and Matilda form an unusual relationship as she becomes his protege. Protege and learns... dot, dot, dot. That's where the description actually ends.
No, if you actually click on it...
little button says more.
It doesn't say more. It actually... she becomes... Smartass. And she becomes his protege and learns the assassin trade. I gotta say, my favorite thing so far in this whole movie, the one that made me laugh the most, is how she lies through the whole movie and everybody buys it. Like, how old are you? I'm 18. I can show you my license.
Yeah, they don't really bother on that. Actually, I gotta say, one of the things that really sold me on this film is the opening scene with Leon. And
the phone scene
where he goes and kills this guy's pretty much all his henchmen, and you have all the music, and then you have that beat in the background, like your heart is beating really fast, and he's sitting there looking around, and the knife comes up on his throat.
Yeah, just kind of, you don't see Leon.
It's Jansen. Just the knife. It sneaks up and gets on his throat, and I thought the way that Luc Besson did this. Where he stopped the music dead at that moment. It was going really quick, and then all of a sudden that happens, and it stops. I thought the way they did that was one of those where it just grabs you.
And I love the scene. I love the scene. You know, guy just, you know, Leon just hands him the phone.
Yeah.
The whole opening's amazing. It's funny. I actually saw this, the American release version, in theaters in 94. And as far as I know, in our area, there was one theater, and it was an hour and a half away or 45 minutes away to actually see this movie.
That's the determination to go see it.
Which is funny, because I'm the only person I know. I don't know. Did you see it in theater?
No.
I think I'm the only person I know who actually saw this in theater.
I saw it shortly after its VHS release, people.
VHS. Yeah, me too.
I want to point out something. John just brought this up, that he saw the American version. There are two versions out there. There's Leon the Professional, which is the European release. It has, I think, 15, 20 minutes more footage. And then there is the Professional, which was the American release. And the American release didn't have the section of her actually going out and attempting to do the kills and those types of things, and deeply learning the trade. They just kind of skimmed over it in the American
version. Yeah, like what I remember, it's been 20 plus years since I've seen this. The one scene I remember is the hike, that guy walking through.
You mean the jogging?
The jogging
political
scene.
Guy of something.
The jogging really scene I remember. The scenes that stuck out to me was when he was actually going door to door.
Yeah, they didn't do that in the American version, where they're going door to door, and he's teaching her, okay, you don't shoot the guy in the face because you don't get paid if they can't recognize the person. And you do a shot here to stop him, and then another one in his heart to finish him, and those types of things.
And the other thing I don't remember is much sexual tension. Like Matilda, basically...
That was
know,
in the American version.
I don't... See, to me, I don't remember it as much. Maybe it just didn't stand out as much.
There was one or two things.
Mark calling Orson.
Might have to stop the video stream.
Okay,
Ryan, we lost you there.
All right. damn it, now I lost my train of thought. Shit.
Yeah. I was wondering those guys. But... So, one of the things I want to bring up for
Ryan... Well, I'll tell you a couple of things I wanted to mention.
Okay.
For the life throughout the whole thing. Just makes me miss the 90s. Shit, am I breaking up again?
Yes. Yeah, a little bit. But we're listening. You're enough to where we can understand you.
It just takes a little...
with her being able to lie, just makes me miss the 90s. They did cut out a couple of things that sort of had a little more of the awkward tension between the two of them. But that's the kind of shit that's taken out because the Los Angeles testing audience didn't like those particular scenes. So on behalf of Los Angeles, I apologize to the movie going public.
See, that to me, I always thought was weird because some of the movies that they were like, oh, yes, it's a great movie, and they disprove of like a couple of scenes always strikes me as kind of odd.
The thing about the sexual tension between him and Matilda is, you know, it's a little girl having a crush, and her whole family's dead. She's just clinging to the guy, trying to make him happy, and that's the way that she sees her mom be happy with her dad and the sister and things like that. So that's
the way Jean Reno plays the character a little slow. Not the brightest ball. What was that?
Not to play what?
Oh, I was going to say, lost my train of thought again. Stupid thing broke up.
He wasn't the brightest bulb in the bunch, and I actually thought that played perfectly with her continuous hitting on him. I thought the way that played out was perfect.
Yeah.
I remember what I was going to say. Not to play Sigmund Freud, is what I was going to start with. But she's looking for a new father figure.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously, the one that she had sucked ass. So, it's all these crazy, crazy heightened emotions for a 12-year-old girl, and she's sort of misplacing them. And Jean Reno, his character, is basically doing the only thing that he knows how to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, well, this is how I survived this long. I mean, that's the only thing that I can teach you. I mean, it's that's why I liked his reluctance. Because it's like, oh shit, I have no idea what to do with a child, you know. And then not to mention the whole her parents and family getting murdered thing was so eerie the entire way that it played out. But it served the most amazing purpose in as much as you're totally on her side throughout the rest of the movie. You're like, I forgive anything that you do.
And
you know,
I find it pretty amusing in a movie for a morally ambiguous characters. You're rooting for the most dangerous one of them.
Yeah, I always like that. But, you know, the thing is Gary Oldman, for me, this is one of his strangest roles. And that's saying something, people.
But this is another movie where he's creepy and he's such an amazing character actor.
Yeah,
he leans into a real hard on this one.
The most amazing thing is right after this, he did Fifth Element playing Zurg.
Oh, God, so good.
And the craziest thing about this, I was actually doing a really quick reading. It's actually in the IMBD notes. Jean Besson?
Luc Besson.
Luc Besson, whatever his name is. Actually, he wrote it in 30 days, filmed it in 90. That's guerrilla filming.
Yeah,
it is, but not to mention, I mean, the same way that we were talking about Guy Ritchie a week and a half ago or so, and it's the same thing with Quentin Tarantino. It's a really specific that you're watching, you know, when you're watching these movies. The movies themselves are almost high concept, really simple. A 12-year-old girl becomes an assassin, you know, but you're almost in it for the style of storytelling, you know?
Oh, yeah. I was also thinking about what you said, Ryan, about he doesn't know how to raise a kid. I'd also say if her character was a male boy, I don't think this would have played off as well as having a female character, somebody he can't relate to at all. In any sense, I think that awkwardness plays off very well as kind of like, well, fuck.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, this for me is pretty much the pinnacle of Natalie Portman's career. I think this is her best role. Hold on. This is probably her best job acting right up there with V for Vendetta. What do you guys think? I mean,
I think it's head and shoulders above pretty much any other 12-year-old actor that I can think of. I definitely think she really developed into like one of my favorite actresses. She is killer in pretty much anything she does.
I wasn't a fan of her as Padme.
Well,
honestly. Obviously the George, I don't let George Lucas sort of color my vision,
but of Natalie Portman.
She's done so many amazing things.
But 1, 2, and 3 sucked ass.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't her. That was more George Lucas versus
her. That's my point. Yeah. Is I'm not going to let his mistakes, you know, like color an otherwise an incredible career that she's had, you know?
Yeah. If you look at, for audience members that aren't familiar with the 90s type of film, when seeing technically Natalie Portman was actually 13, but that's just stupid nitpicking.
Well, she was smoking. She
was smoking, and she actually was taking drags on it too. Now, most of them would be like, oh my God. But you know, that was not so uncommon in the 90s. I mean, I started smoking when I was literally 11, 12.
Well, I think the difference of it is in the 90s, it wasn't so much hidden. You know, it was culture, so let's show it. It wasn't this, it happens, let's not hide it. And which is one of the things I think adds to it, because there's 5 smoking scenes in the movie, but every little element that happens in this movie adds to it. When she snuck back into the house and got the 20 grand from the floorboards, that adds to the house and that adds to the movie, and you didn't even necessarily have to have that scene.
Yeah, I agree. Now there is that one scene that I want to see what you guys thought of this one. There's the scene where John Reno stands up when he's sleeping in the chair, goes up and puts the gun in Natalie Portman's head. It sits there for a moment and then walks back. Now, for me, that always spoke to me of the thing where, you know, he hears a different sound when he's sleeping. And he goes to silence it and get the burden off his back. I mean, what do you guys think of that one?
See,
because I thought that was a very interesting scene to throw in there.
See,
I thought it was basically like I can't do this, and I can't just turn her out onto the street. The one thing I know how to do is just erase somebody.
See,
you know what I mean? Like sort of a mercy killing, but also kind of a selfish. I don't want the responsibility. You know?
See, yeah. I totally agree with Ryan. I don't think it's I think it's totally on him being selfish. Is he wanted her out? He couldn't get rid of her, and his conscience won't let him kick her out
because no women, no kids,
no children.
Yeah, so I think this has nothing to do with her more than the fact that he feels stuck. So this is a perfect way to get rid of her, but his morals is stopping him from doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much just like I can do this so easily and then go back to the way things were. But, you know, like, obviously he's got a code, you know, sort of like most film assassins.
True. So, you know, I thought that was always an interesting scene in a lot of it. And there was a lot of unsaid stuff in that. And I don't think it would have.
Like that you come at it.
Huh?
I said, I like that you're coming at it from this like grizzled military perspective. Like, what's this new noise? Got to stop it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way I would think about it. You know, I can't sleep. Damn it. There's something
some old else. Veteran, some old veteran with PTSD.
See, I'll be honest. I'm kind of shocked that Ryan and I agree on this. I mean, usually it would be the two of you knowing,
but you know, it's something outside of his norm. And that's what is throwing him off. But
I would say it's
know,
outside
I think
of his
the
control.
Scene, if there was any dialogue or narrative, would have taken away from it.
Oh yeah, totally.
Because it gives the audience something that they're like, whoa, 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 what is he doing?
And in all honesty, the greatest writing in this movie is never said.
Yeah.
And I think that's the strongest part of this movie is the storytelling that where there's no talking. It's the actions. Like at the end when he grabbed Gary Oldman's hand. I mean, there was talking, but that whole scene at the end really added to the emotional aspect of that scene.
Yeah, I understand. Now, one of the things that really bothered me,
I guess not,
in this film is now the sniper scene where he's like, stay away from the windows. And then he goes and tries to get the plant, and they unload constantly in there. Snipers aren't going to do that. They're not going to waste ammo on that. It's not like, have you ever heard of a sniper doing suppressing fire?
Well,
no, and they give away their position. So that always bothered me. But now I understood the SWAT guys just blasting the door and all
that.
Well,
these
crap.
Are all corrupt cops.
No, not all of them. Because he had to go and get everyone.
Yeah.
Which was one of my favorite scenes in the whole thing where Gary Oldman just flips out. What do you mean by everyone? Everyone.
Well, I mean, you know, the good guy's so effing low key that I mean, he had to go right back over the top, you know.
Yeah.
And not to the film's detriment. I mean, I don't really consider it overacting. I mean, he was a kind of a nut bar character, but that's Gary Oldman doing what he does.
Yeah. I actually think that scene like added to it, because you could see it seemed to me that this whole situation was kind of like stressing him out. It was getting to him. Or I thought that scene right there just showed like how unstable that character was.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah, to mention all the drugs that he's popping throughout the whole thing.
They don't go into the details of them.
I love the good cop, bad cop at the beginning of the film. You don't really want me to interrupt his musical listening.
Yeah, I always thought that was funny. And then he's like sitting there and he's like, I love Beethoven and you're a Mozart fan. Just that whole thing. And it's like, the dude has probably never heard Mozart in his entire life.
But he was a reggae fan.
Yeah. That was the guy that played David Berkowitz in the Son of Sam movie.
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Played a great David Burke. I mean, you know, for the 8 seconds of dialogue that he had.
Yeah, so, you know, I also want to throw in that I've always wanted a sequel done by Natalie Portman.
I know, right, where she's 26 and just all gangster. And
yeah, well, she's like 34 now.
Well, sure, yeah.
You know, in all honesty, I don't know. That'd have to be a very specific, very well thought out script.
I don't see
that him doing that.
No, I mean, because there's no other premise for it other than, hey, she's.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree.
But I think if Luc Besson did it, it would actually. I think if he
put it'd be a whole clock.
That was weird. he literally was drinking this bottle and he was still talking. I would like to see a sequel. I think if Luc Besson stepped up and actually did it and put the effort in, I think it would be good. He probably has a script for it in his repertoire.
See, I get worried when I start thinking about that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, I don't have the sort of the fear with Luc Besson as the person I'm about to mention. But Boondock Saints.
Yes, I was going to say Boondock Saints. That's what
it's the perfect example of, like, you have no story that goes beyond your first movie, but out of whole cloth came up with this secondary thing where you almost just kept pulling the fun parts from the first movie and just transplanting them into this inferior story.
Which, by the way, is reason I've never seen the second Boondock Saints and will refuse to.
Do yourself a favor, don't.
So
I saw it, too, just because I'm like, all right, you know, I'm going to sit down and actually watch it. It's just... like Ryan said, it's the perfect example of what not to do with a sequel.
It was just like how excited I was about there was a Green Street Hooligans 2 until I read it, dude, and I'm like, there's no way I can watch this. This is going to literally piss me off.
I think I saw 10 minutes of it, and it was right after seeing this Boondock Saints 2, and I'm like, I'm not going to do this to myself.
Or the third one. So, Ryan, what do you give this movie?
It's a three of a movie, but Luc Besson pulls it into a four just on his style and his incredible sensibility when it comes to making action movies.
Yeah.
James?
Kind of the same thing. I say it this way, is not the best out there. And there are a few things that aren't that great, but you know, it comes down to the fact that, I mean, this one, it has great rewatchability. And also one of the best death scenes I've seen in a long time. By Jean Reno.
Yeah, I mean, hell yeah. You can tell Luc Besson is a fan of these kinds of movies, and that's what he was doing. It was just an homage, you know?
Gene Reno did a good job dying.
Yeah, he did. He really did. And he didn't drag it out. He got what he needed to say, gave the guy the ring, died.
Thank God it wasn't a Trinity scene.
Yeah, I'm thinking, like, after the Trinity scene, like, a 3-minute death scene is almost acceptable. 9 minutes.
See, for me, this movie doesn't have great rewatchability, hence the reason I've only seen it 2 or 3 times in 20 years. But I actually have to give it a 4 to 5 because the casting in this movie is excellent. The color, the acting, everything in this movie fits really well with each other. So it's a 4 to 5. I mean, this to me is almost like filmmaking 101. To get things really well together.
We didn't even bring up Danny Aiello's character.
No.
As sort of the father figure to Jean Reno, you know what I mean? That was that whole little interaction between them. You can see how kind of why Jean Reno has his personality. It's like he's raising this kid from terrible things, and you can really see the same thing in Danny Aiello's character.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to switch. Hold on. We're going to have to switch. We're running out of
time. He brought it up. I'll finish it. I didn't go off on my notes on this one, but I did have it in there where it's the scene where they're sitting there. He's getting the training gun, and he goes, and Danny Aiello says to him, go open it up and make sure it's the thing you're looking for. He goes, no, I trust you. He goes, one thing does not have to do with the other.
Yeah.
I thought that was a fantastic line and response.
So with that being said, we're going to have to switch to the TV show that we forgot to talk to last week, which was...
Jessica Jones.
And I'll be honest, I was not really impressed with this TV show.
Slow.
See, the weird part is the slow didn't really bug me. I just thought this movie was...
Show.
I thought the show was strange because it seemed to turn everything on its head just to turn everything on its head. You have a very girl power movie, all the TV show, all the guys are scumbags. And it doesn't seem to, at least from the first episode, have a reason for that.
No. Not that I saw.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to have a reason for much in the first episode. I mean, it was a story with like as little kind of exposition as possible, which, I mean, there's good things to start. I mean, like a good cold opening of a show, I mean, where you're just kind of thrown into a world, but this one definitely did lean pretty heavy on those kind of tropes, and not to say that, you know, like the girl power thing was bad. I mean,
well, no, I re Ryan, you there? I totally agree with Ryan that it wasn't bad, but it just didn't add anything to the TV show for me at all. It just left me kind of, you know, emotionally not attached to the TV show, and you know, I totally get, okay, just going to throw you in this world, but the world didn't interest me. Okay, so she's a metahuman, and
yeah.
I've seen so many freaking superhero movies in the last 10 years. A metahuman, eh?
Yeah. You didn't get to see enough of sort of the potential of the down the road kind of thing. Like, oh, this is going to be epic because of this little hint of this. I mean, it was if they're leading into something big. I mean, it seems like they're taking their time.
I did. I did love the making fun of Superman though. Laser beams out of my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was the only thing.
And there are those kinds of fun things, but and again, I mean, this is not saying that it's a bad show or is going to be a bad show. I mean, it, by all accounts, could get a lot better. But from a purely sort of a pilot standpoint,
it's a failure.
I mean, there does have to be something to get you interested in the things to come.
Yeah. I would say that if this was on the Alphabet channels, it wouldn't make it. I don't even think this would make it on cable. Just from the opening itself, there was nothing in this first show that even made me want to see the second one at all. There's nothing.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, do you think that a thing like Netflix is doing this kind of a thing because they know they're playing the long con? They know they have the season where everybody can kind of watch. Do they assume that the audience is not just going to watch the first episode right then?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is long format storytelling at its best. They can throw an entire season, and people binge watch Netflix. So instead of watching one, they're going to say, okay, they're going to watch four. So over episode 1, 2, 3, and 4, they can introduce everything. So yeah, I think that's the only reason they did this.
But at the same time, though, I mean, when we're talking about superhero stuff, we're talking about another Marvel thing. I understand they were really going for a female audience. But that being said, I mean, I definitely don't shy away from like just a heavy female cast at all.
No, that doesn't bug me at all.
I agree with the fact.
They seem to offer a new genre. I'm not saying go and reinvent the wheel before you can make a superhero show, but you know, give some kind of indicator that this is going to go, you know, some kind of an interesting road that possibly we haven't seen before.
When what you said though, this is they're totally, I think, aiming for a female audience, but they also have to deal with comic book geeks, and I personally think those two are really hard to balance.
Yeah, I think so, because they have to assume that, I mean, that, you know, not a lot of the women that are going to be watching the show. I mean, it's more of like an intro to superheroes for these women. Like, they're just going to pepper in the supernatural or the metahuman kind of thing.
I do have to say, though, without, because I do feel like we've been bashing it. The one interesting part of the first episode was explaining Jessica Jones' PSD. That whole part of the story is at least interesting to me enough. Okay, so something happened. She's a metahuman. There's at least one bit of gripping story that I thought, okay, this has to be the fruit that makes people watch the second episode. Because the whole freaking show so far is about that.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, James, any comments?
So, I guess pretty much covered up. I mean, I jumped in and went for the 3-episode binge and...
Yeah, I didn't get past the first one.
Yeah, I probably will not continue on with it.
Yeah, so that's the thing is, I mean, it's one of those that after the first episode, I wasn't against watching another one, but by the time, you know, a couple of days went by, it just kind of slipped my mind. It was nothing that remembered like, oh, I got to watch the second one of that.
No, exactly. See, that's where I'm at. After I watched the first one, that line from Top Gun kicked in, you know, sorry, Ghost Rider, pattern's full. I just couldn't watch anymore. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to let you know, we do have a Facebook page. Do you somewhere. Love us, hate us? You could even tell us suck, as long as you're creative about it. We'll read you on air. And also, how about Pods for the Cause? Donate to Old Guy Tech TV and help keep the lights on. And James has movie news.
So, have you guys ever heard of the French comic series Valerian and Loreline?
Like Valerian Root? No.
No. This is I guess from what I understand, it's a comic book that helped to give a little bit of inspiration into some elements in Star Wars and a few in The Fifth Element. Kind of took little bits and pieces and kind of meshed it up and regurgitated it.
How old is it?
This is like the 1970s from what I'm finding.
Okay, so this is a... Okay.
Oh, no, I apologize. It was created in 67.
Okay, so this is the foundation of certain genres.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is like one of those really big sci-fi films, and we were just talking about Luc Besson, and he is being putting this together.
So is it like
an escape my radar?
So is this like a space opera saga like Star Wars?
Yes, this is going to be a space opera, sci-fi, hardcore type thing going on. Hmm. And now the reason why I noticed it is because this was, I guess, released in the news back in May of this year. But John Goodman, I noticed, has been cast for a voice character. So good guy to, I don't good know. Guy there's some things that I could see going on with this. I really enjoy The Fifth Element. That's one of those out there that most sci-fi fans enjoy.
Well, the
scene, yeah,
yeah,
and I mean, that's Fifth... another one by Luc Besson. This is
and Gary Oldman,
which is which is a movie we've yet to do somehow.
Just haven't gone.
But Fifth Element is amazing for a couple of reasons. It's actually a reference movie for people testing televisions because of the colors. Because they go from crisp darks to very bright, bright colors.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those that I'll keep my eye on it, see what's going on with it. But
I told him I'm down for another space opera as long as it's good. I love stuff like that, especially if it's hard sci-fi.
Yeah, but I'm always in for that kind of thing. You know, I mean, it's the thing about watching Star Wars. After it's over, you're like, well, shit, let's keep this train rolling.
See, I thought that until I saw 1, 2, and 3. I'm like, maybe we should stop this train, but maybe I'm not. Well,
obviously, we consider that an isolated incident, and there's forgivable things about it, and there's not. But that being said, it's canon still, you know?
That's true, and you do have, you know, you do have the most evil character in the history known to man now in control of it, the mouse.
Right, yeah.
So, and the mouse is all about entertainment and this and that. So, I don't actually see them...
Keep it kosher.
Oh, jeez. I actually don't see them doing bad on the new Star Wars.
Oh, neither do I.
I think they're going to toe the line.
J.J. Abrams as a filmmaker. Kosher.
Jeez.
So...
And I want to go back to what James said about the movie he was talking about. I'm excited because all of Luc Besson's Besson's movies are very well done.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't see him kowtowing to anybody over anything. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out.
Yeah, hopefully we're green on it, and yeah, super green.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd love to see him do another sci-fi movie. I mean, he almost changed what sci-fis look like with Fifth Element.
Yeah,
yeah.
That is such a visually stunning, stunning movie. You know, and I mean, pulled together pulled the band back together with the cast, man, with between Mila Jovovich and Gary Oldman. Oh man, so good.
Wow. So next week's movie is Ryan's pick, and you may or may not love it, but it's his turn. So Ryan, what are you doing now?
Super.
All right. Well, okay. So we were doing movies that we own, and I've gone through like three different iterations of a giant movie collection, and now I hardly own anything at all. So I'm kind of rifling through like old DVDs, and the one that I don't think we've done, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh shit, we got to do this because it's just a trip of a movie. I don't have any of the details in front of me, which sucks. But Guy Pearce, Memento.
Yes. A movie, by the way, apparently they're freaking redoing.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ.
See, here's the thing. I don't know if you guys don't know who Guy Pearce is, look him up. He's actually one of my all-time favorite actors. The first time I ever saw him was, what the frick is that movie? This really sucks, but because he plays a cop detective, L.A. Confidential.
Yeah,
one of my all-time favorite movies, which another one I haven't picked yet. I've been waiting for the perfect moment.
One of my favorite character actors, Joey Pants, is in this one too. So
awesome. All right. So I gave the movie Leon the Professional, not to be confused with Leon. Somebody just got a mushroom. I gave the movie 4 out of 5. James gave it a 4 to 5. Ryan gave it a 4 to 5. Next week is the movie Memento. And do we have a TV show?
No, I don't think we do. There's a TV show coming out in January that I'm looking forward to. But
we fucking mentioned something last week, but neither James and I can remember it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if we do a TV show,
we can do the first episode of Walking Dead. See what John thinks about it.
It was something else. It was something obvious.
Watch this space or our Facebook page, and it's to be announced. And as always, thank you for watching. We'll be right back.